When I say, you know, quality over quantity, we don't want, like, you know, to sign up 500 million users and then, you know, offer one thing that works for them and make money off that. We would rather identify the population that will benefit the most from our services and offer them better quality support. So better quality features, better quality support, better quality experience, everything included.
You're listening to The Data Point of View. A podcast for anyone interested in using machine learning and consumer data to achieve business objectives. In each episode, members of the Mobile Wallet team are joined by industry leaders and influencers to discuss different ways data and technology can improve predictive modeling, feature engineering, and data enrichment. Let's jump in.
Thank you for listening today. I'm Lori Hood, CMO at Mobile Wallet, and this is Data Point of View. Data Point of View is a podcast for anyone interested in using machine learning and consumer data to achieve business objectives. Joining me for this episode is Simran Singh. Simran is Vice President, Banking as a Service at Green Dot Corporation. Green Dot's mission is to deliver trusted, best-in-class money management and payment solutions to their customers and partners, seamlessly connecting people to their money. Simran also spent 4 years at PayPal in multiple roles before his move to Green Dot. Simran, welcome to the program and thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure's all mine, Lori. Looking forward to our conversation.
Well, fantastic. So we're going to go ahead and just jump right in. We're going to start talking a bit about your background and the path that led to your current role, and then focus on how you and your team are using machine learning to drive innovation and customer experience, and close with your thoughts on 2022. So, you've had a variety of roles in your career in different industries. You received your undergraduate degree from the Indian Institute of Technology, Delhi. And from what I hear, the Indian Institute of Technology is where all of the smartest people in India go.
Yeah, now, that's
certainly,
right.
I have heard that from all of my colleagues who have gone there. So there may be a little bit of internal Mobile Wallet bias on that. But then you went back, super impressive, and got your MBA from the Wharton School of Business. So talk a little bit about how kind of your early jobs, your early roles, your education have shaped your career and your career choices.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting journey. And looking back at it, gives you, you know, times like this, when you take a pause and look back at it, it reminds you that some deliberate decisions and some spontaneous decisions have brought you where you are. So I did my undergrad in computer science and mathematics. And unlike everybody who goes into the computer science space and becomes a techie, I decided to delve in the business side of things. I was always fascinated by the fact that you can create the best product, but if you don't know how to sell it, if you don't know how to package it, if you don't bring it to life, essentially, that for me was the most challenging part. So after my undergrad, I went to a management consulting firm, which I think is one of the best training grounds for anybody out there. The firm was called Parthenon, and I was employee number 3 for their emerging markets practice.
Wow.
You'll soon see a trend of me taking decisions to move to places which are not as well known, but it give you a great chance for learning.
I'm going to jump in. I would absolutely agree with you on the management consulting experience. I spent 5 years at Accenture out of college, and will say that I have kept what I learned there and the things I saw there with me. It is a fantastic training ground.
Absolutely agree. I use some of the toolkits, some of the ways you analyze a problem, even as of today, even though, you know, things change over time, but the principles that you use still remain the same. So I spent 2.5 years with Parthenon, primarily working in their education practice, helping both not-for-profit and for-profit education institutions do international expansion, M&A, just thinking about the strategy overall. And one of the clients that I worked for was a private equity fund called Baring Private Equity Asia. Maybe listeners in the US might not be very familiar with them, but they're the largest Asia-focused fund when it comes to private equity funds. And they liked the work that we had done for them. And they asked if I would become a part of their investment. Very naively, I still remember this conversation. I had thought I would be a lifetimer in management consulting. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And when they made the offer, I remember speaking to my partner at Parthenon. He said, Simran, even if you want to stay, I will not let you stay, because the only way you evolve is by taking risks and doing things differently than you've done before. So spent 2 years at Baring, learned how to analyze companies and understand that even if they're not perfect companies, you can financially engineer a way to make them better than what they are in legal ways. And then I think at the back of my mind, the entrepreneurial bug, the idea of doing something on your own was always, scratching me and itching.
Yeah, get that.
With two other friends from IIT, Indian Institute of Technology as well, we started, when we got together, we didn't have an idea. We just wanted to do something. That was all that we were trying to do. And e-commerce or online shopping was very nascent in India. So what we built was a company called Byte, which the easiest way to describe that would be the Google Shopping equivalent in India. So you have one interface and you can get access to all the different marketplaces. And, just like that, we had grown to like $1 million in ARR, and these three 23-year-olds, 24-year-olds did not know what to do from that point onward. And we saw ourselves plateau for 6 months, not knowing how do we take it from, we knew how to take it from 0 to 1, but 1 to 10 is a very different skill set that is required. So we decided to sell it off to a Sequoia-backed tech company, which wanted to use our technology. So what they do is they are a publishing house, a publishing tech platform. So whenever you're browsing, let's say an article about Motorola, and you can actually, our technology would enable them to showcase how Motorola phones are available at these different marketplaces, and then they can take an affiliate commission out of it as well. So then came to business school at Wharton. I think this experience had shown that just by doing things, you can get somewhere. But if you know how to do things, you can go even further. Loved my 2 years at Wharton. Some of my best friends are still friends that I made at that place. And then when I graduated, I decided to work at a tech firm called VMware, where I was doing product management. And you will start seeing now that I've had my fingers in multiple pies, and that has been a very deliberate decision. So after VMware, I went to start the strategy and business development functions at a very small fintech called Hyperwallet. People had never even heard of it. It was actually a Canadian company that was looking to come to the US. But the thing that I use to make career decisions is the work that I'm going to do, is it going to have an impact? And that's all that it matters to me. It doesn't matter if it's a product-related role, it's a business development, it's a strategy role. We grew Hyperwallet to a fairly large scale, and we were eventually acquired by PayPal in 2018. Did spend some time with PayPal for a while, and now, as you mentioned, at another fintech called Green Dot, which where again, we are, I think, a fairly underutilized asset and under-recognized brand name as well. But the kind of solutions that we provide are exactly the kind of solutions that a large majority of the American consumer is looking for.
Well, and that sort of tees it up to get to my next question. Switching gears to your current role, Green Dot's got this really interesting evolution story. So can you talk a little bit about kind of how providing your financial services products really led you to become a best-in-class technology company?
Yeah, if you thought my own professional journey was interesting, wait till you hear about Green Dot. So Green Dot was actually started by a DJ, and you heard that right, a disc jockey. When he would go play at concerts and in music venues, he'd realize that most of his target population is students, and they didn't have access to pay by card. So if, he would link them to his, let's say, his music set that's uploaded online and say, hey, but this is before Apple Store, right? So, hey, pay using a debit card or credit card. They weren't as prevalent then. And, the easiest way would be to use your your parents' debit card, and then they could track how much spending you're doing, which was not the what the students wanted. So he started a prepaid card company. Essentially, you get a card from a Walmart or a Walgreens, and you could load funds onto that card, and grew it to be a successful business. It went public in 2009. But I think what I've always appreciated about Green Dot is that, much like any other evolving player, they've realized the changing of times. They realized that prepaid cards are becoming, the norm. So they actually went and acquired a bank in 2011. We are one of the few, I can actually name them on one hand, a few fintech players that have a banking license as of today. And then, as digital commerce, online marketplaces such as Uber, Amazon started becoming more and more prevalent, Green Dot thought about, hey, what can we do for us to be able to serve more customers, maybe not directly, but through a partnership? So one of the first companies that we tied up with was Uber. As an Uber driver, you get access to a Green Dot bank account and Green Dot card, which allows you to get paid instantly. You can use that to get cashback rewards. You can get discounts at, say, a gas station or an auto repair shop. So suddenly, from this plastic prepaid card company, which is available in a retail store, we had transformed, not overnight, but over 15 years, into a technology company, which was offering our technology and our banking license to partners who were looking to offer financial services. And, it's now one of our largest growing segments when it comes to offering banking as a service to our partners. Some of our partners' names that you might have heard of: Apple, Uber, Amazon, Intuit, Stash, Wealthfront, just to name a few.
That's awesome. And it feels like that's a growing market in the U.S. Emerging financial services companies, really do need to differentiate to win market share. So can you talk about some of the things that you're doing at a high level with machine learning? Let's pull that in, that makes you better than the competition.
Yeah, I think you're fairly right that financial services can become very commoditized. But when you think about the population that you're looking to serve, it's very important to understand, what are they exactly looking for? What is working? What is not working? And the traditional way of doing it was, we'll do surveys and focus groups. And there's so much noise in those signals. You're a technology company, so how can you use technology to glean out the similar type of insights as to understand your customer preferences, what is working, what is not working? And that's what I like about the way Green Dot uses machine learning. It's not a buzzword that we throw around and say, hey, we are a machine learning driven company. It's so easy to say, what's the use case that you're serving using machine learning? And for us, it's to be able to understand our customer preferences and to be able to cluster our customers as well, to understand, okay, this is one specific set of customers who are using Green Dot primarily for, as a store of money. There's another set of customers who are using Green Dot primarily to be able to shop online. There's another set of customers who wants to be able to deposit cash at a retail store. And by being able to use machine learning to cluster and understand the behaviors of these clusters differently, I think that provides us a competitive edge, because when, let's say, Uber comes and talks to us, we can help them understand what is exactly it is that their driver is looking from a financial services perspective. Obviously, nobody knows the driver's driving preferences or timing preferences than Uber, but helping them understand the financial services aspect of it and being able to back that up using data that we've gathered, either through cluster analysis or some other behavioral patterns that we've recognized, that is such a powerful way of building a partnership, not a vendor relationship, right? Like they then understand, okay, if we work with Green Dot, not only are we getting access to the best in class financial services, but also a partner that will work together with us to understand what is the best experience we can provide to our drivers. And that's what matters the most to them.
And then how do you use those learnings to impact the customer experience on your end.
Yeah. So once you start analyzing those behavioral patterns of the clusters, three things emerge. One, it helps from understanding what features we need to build, what are lacking, what are things that customers are just not using, and we can actually pull them out. And you can do it by different clusters rather than for the entire population. That's the easiest way of understanding it. Second is the ability to offer better customer support. What I mean by that is, because you are able to understand the behavioral patterns of each of these clusters, you can actually assign customer support, which works better for one cluster versus the other. You train them on more of those aspects of a certain cluster. And third is in terms of then being able to either sign newer partners or open up a financial services for a bigger group within an existing partner. So with Amazon, for example, you know, let's say we are currently serving their driver population, whose financial service needs will be very different from their seller population, right? Yeah. So Amazon, it's a behemoth. It serves so many different populations. So it's this combination of being able to understand what is the right feature set that works for a population, what's the right customer support that works for that population, and then being able to open up more of these populations, either within an existing partner or a new partner, that machine learning allows us to unlock.
Very cool. So when we were preparing for this session, you know, you shared that the play at Green Dot is, it's more of a quality relationship with that customer versus a quantity relationship. You know, what does that mean for your business? How do you really think about that and sort of tie that to what I said earlier, kind of the mission statement, which is, you know, Green Dot connecting people to their money.
Yeah. So the relationship with money is...
I wish I had more of it.
that's a constant we hear from everyone. But I think, you know, when you're a technology company, often the services that you're offering to an end user, the responsibility that you have can vary. But when it comes to handling people's money and the kind of population that we're serving, it's mostly unbanked or underbanked who are you know, depending on Green Dot to be able to run their daily lives. So when I say, you know, quality over quantity, we don't want, like, you know, to sign up 500 million users and then, you know, offer one thing that works for them and make money off that. We would rather identify the population that will benefit the most from our services and offer them better quality support. So better quality features, better quality support, better quality experience, everything included. So that's what I mean by quality over quantity. It's not, hey, we will unleash every feature that we can build. No, we want to understand what is it that works for a specific population, how can we package it in the best way that it works for them, and then bring it to life so that they are actually getting real value out of Green Dot, and not just, you know, it's not just another financial service that they're using.
And that ties to kind of what you had said previously about using that machine learning to really dig into what your customers' needs are, what they're doing, and then how can you better serve them?
Yeah. And, you know, 30% of people who have a Green Dot account, it's their primary bank account, be it through our partner or directly through Green Dot. So think about that, right? Like, if you're not serving them in the right manner, and on top of it, it's their money that you're handling, you know, let's say it's your Netflix streaming service, goes down for 10 minutes, fine, it's an inconvenience, but it's not impacting your life. Some people might argue otherwise, but that's at least but if your bank goes down, if the balance that you see in your account is not correct, if you know, we don't charge for overdrafts. Think about who gets hit with most with the overdrafts, people who cannot pay the overdraft fee. Yep. So those yep. kind of building that kind of an experience driven by insights that we glean from machine learning, that I think is the most powerful thing you can build for a customer.
Well, and there's just a level of trust with the banking relationship, and that's huge. So, you know, you're in a business that's highly driven by data and AI. You know, we talked a little bit about the use of machine learning. So when you're looking at your data science and your machine learning strategies and where you want to invest your resources, what are some of the key principles? What are you thinking of as a leader in terms of how you're driving this in the organization?
I think the biggest challenge for us is just the amount of data that we get. I think at least 50 million people have had a Green Dot product in their lifetime. That's like 1/6 of the US population, right? And now think about all the transactions you do on that account, volume of the transaction, dollar value of the transaction, frequency of the transaction, where are you spending the money? So it's an overwhelming amount of data that you get to play with, which is very exciting from a data scientist perspective, right? So there's no dearth of quality data that you're getting. In terms of the principles that we use from a data analysis or you know, data intelligence perspective, we don't do data analysis just for the sake of doing data analysis. There always has to be either a business problem that you're looking to solve or some form of additional insight that this data analysis would provide. So I don't want to know 75% of our transactions happen between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. So what? Oh, what if we were able to incentivize users to spend more during 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. because 75% of our transactions are happening at that stage? Those are the kind of insights that data business insights team is supposed to bring to the leadership team and to be able to drive our business, both in terms of getting new users or making sure that existing users get more value out of it. So just data analysis for the sake of data analysis is anybody can do it, and it's not adding any value.
No, very, very, very good insight. So as we head into year three of the pandemic, who would have thought we would have said that 2 years ago? You know, COVID's affected businesses in different ways. You know, how do you feel? How's COVID impacted your business, both how you're working internally, but also, you know, have you seen that relationship with the customer change?
I think I love to joke about the fact that people often ask, who was your chief digitization officer? And COVID-19 should be the answer, because both internally and with our customers, what I've seen is the rate of change got accelerated. You got a lot of the growth pulled in or front-loaded from a user growth perspective or user value perspective as well. Internally, we were one of the first companies to go fully remote forever. So we were originally based out of LA. 90% of our employee base was within 10 miles of the office. Oh, it's LA, so might be even higher. I'm based in San Francisco. I would have never considered an opportunity in Southern California. I was just talking to our head of HR the other day, and right now, I think 75% of people we've hired over the last year have come from outside of LA. So suddenly you get access to such a large talent pool, but you also have to make sure as the leadership team that you're equipping the team with the right tools to make sure they're being successful in a remote environment. One of the principles that our CEO imbibes on everyone is responsibility and trust. So I should be able to trust you, and you should be responsible for the outcome of whatever is being asked of you. So we had the chief people officer of Netflix present at our all hands recently, and she said, if you think you've figured out what it means to work in a remote environment, you're kidding yourself, because it's still evolving. You know, we're still figuring what's the right things. And then from an external perspective, as you can expect for a business that runs more on digital payments and even some plastic payments, the use of cash decreased tremendously. We are still, you know, we're the world's largest economy, but our cash dependency is still very, very, very high as compared to some of the other economies that you see.
Yep.
China, yep. Southeast Asia, even Western Europe, there's not as much cash usage. But over the last 2 years, the number of people who have started using digital payments. And very surprisingly, the number of people have continued to use digital payments once they've gotten the taste for it. That is something that you wouldn't have expected had 2 years ago when the pandemic hadn't been brought in. So in other words, what would have happened 5 years after 2019 happened in 2 years after 2019.
Compress that cycle.
Compress the growth, yeah. And I think it's for the better. When you give access to the same tools that a wealthy rich person has at their disposal to, that's the only way you can bring someone out of the poverty cycle, or the ability to improve their financial lives tremendously, not just by a few inches. Yeah. So yeah. That mission, it's something that dictates every business decision of ours. Again, it's not meant to be just a empty line or empty slogan. We seamlessly want to connect everyone with their money, and specifically want to serve the underbanked and unbanked.
That's so cool. And as you said, I mean, if you can't get access to the tools, to capital, to credit, you don't have the ability to kind of pull yourself up and change your circumstances.
That's correct. And it's easy to say, hey, pull yourselves up by your own bootstraps. But if you need to provide them with the right support to be able to do that, and financial support, be it in terms of the tools, the credit lines, et cetera, that's what will eventually make their lives better.
Yeah. And it lifts everybody when we can do that. Yeah. So kind of as we close, and we sort of went in this direction, talk about kind of, you know, what you see for financial services 2022 and beyond. I mean, it seems like it was an area that was so, an industry that was so stable for so long, and now it's just incredibly dynamic. And you've got what's going on in the U.S. as well as what's going on in emerging markets, which you can think of even is changing more aggressively. So we'd love to hear sort of your quick thoughts on what you think is coming. Look in your crystal ball of financial services.
I like to joke that I run the Ministry of Hammers, so everything looks like a nail to me. But I genuinely believe that over the next 5 to 10 years, companies that have done a great job establishing a direct relationship with their customers, have built trust with them, the Googles, the Amazons of the world, they'll play a larger role in the financial lives of their customers as well. They will use... That doesn't necessarily mean that they would become a bank. And in fact, I think they would be very averse to becoming a bank because it comes with its own regulatory aspects. Let's put it that way. It's not for everyone. So they would be looking for, you know, a third party partner to provide those services on their behalf. But the advantage that they will have over, say, a traditional banking institution is that they understand the behavior of their customers a lot more, because they touch the different journey points in their customers a lot more than a traditional financial institution will do. So they can build products that are very tailored to providing providing financial tools to their end users. And then on a very optimistic note, I think if you look at the number of unbanked and underbanked people in the US today, it is ludicrously large for an economy of our size. Yes. I think as we open up banking services, as it becomes easier for someone to access a bank account, that number will fall very drastically over the next 5 to 10 years. So the combination of everybody who you have a direct customer relationship with can offer you financial services, and the cost of financial services goes down quite tremendously. It makes me very optimistic for the financial services space moving forward.
Yeah. I think generationally as well, I look at my son who's 17 and the things he's doing and how he looks at financial services, and I think that will have a big influence, and there are so more alternatives. They're so much more comfortable just dealing with things in different ways, using technology. You know, there's going to be, we'll do another podcast a year from now and we'll see what's happened as the time has gone by. But with that, Simran, I want to thank you for joining us, for sharing your insights and your story. I really appreciate it. And to our listeners, thank you for your time today, and please join us for another episode of Data Point of View, brought to you by Mobile Walla.
Thank you, Laurie, and thank you, listeners, for listening in.
Thank you for checking out this episode of Data Point of View. This show is brought to you by Mobile Waller. Mobile Waller provides consumer intelligence solutions that help data and marketing professionals better understand, model, and predict consumer behavior so they can acquire and retain their best customers. If you enjoyed what you learned in this episode, make sure to follow Data Point of View wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, or visit mobilewaller.com/podcast to get immediate access to all of the latest episodes. The Data Point of View.